Välkommen till Freuds Toolbox, skolans inspirationspodd med fokus på känslor, relationer, lärande och ledarskap. Tillsammans med Kenneth Freud får du inspireras av och lära av nationellt och internationellt ledande experter på evidensbaserat lärande och ledarskap.
Hi everyone, today's episode we will talk about school leadership or leadership in education, and we have had some episodes before but not one as specific on school leadership as this one. And it's my honor and privilege to introduce to you Professor Vivian Robinson. Most welcome, Vivian.
Thank you Kenneth.
Yeah, and I think this episode is especially for principals and school leaders. And in Sweden, we have like a mandatory program when you become a principal. And I think in many of those programs at universities around Sweden, we have your book, Student-Centered Leadership, as mandatory literature. So quite a number of us are familiar with some of your work, at least. And I hope after this episode, they will know a little bit more. And I would like to base today's talk a bit to your book, Virtuous Educational Leadership, Doing the Right Work the Right Way. And from the beginning, I'm interested in the title. Why did you choose this title, and what does it mean for us
Yes.
as leaders?
Yes. There is a lot of meaning in the title, actually.
Yeah.
The first word, virtuous, signals the fact that I wanted to focus more on leadership character. I've written quite a lot on the leadership knowledge and skills.
Yeah.
And I've become more convinced that leadership motivations, emotions, ways of reasoning, desirable dispositions of character, which is what a virtue is, is really important. Because sometimes when I'm in workshops and I'm coaching principals or school leaders, I feel as if I'm more determined to help them with a very challenging conversation than they are. So I'm wondering, why are they not persevering? Why are they not, you know, more passionate about resolving the issue? So that's just one example of how I came to realize that there was a gap in my work in terms of leadership character. And one of the reasons why I was attracted to Aristotle's notion of virtues was that virtues are highly practical. Aristotle talked about the fact that, you know, you can't be virtuous if you don't know anything. You can't be virtuous if you're unskilled. You can't be virtuous if you have the wrong way of reasoning or thinking about, or you have bad motives. So virtues are desirable dispositions of character. And that's the very new part of this book, which is I had to get into virtue theory and figure out what that meant for educational leaders. Then the subtitle is Doing the Right Work the Right Way.
Yeah.
And of course, I've set myself a very big challenge there, which is how do you decide what the right work is?
Yeah.
And that's where I went back to reading some more contemporary philosophers of education in terms of what are the proper purposes of educational institutions, and used some recent philosophers of education and not so recent to settle on three purposes, which is the preparation of students for a fulfilling career and life journey, preparing them in ways that socialize them into relevant communities, whether they're disciplinary communities or cultural communities, and that build their ability to be autonomous without being subject to the whims of their own and other people's internal or external drives. In other words, autonomous self-regulation rather than just pure autonomy. And so with those proper purposes, then you, if that's the proper, and I would argue distinctive purposes of education, then you need to be ground, then you have to say, well, what is the work that is involved in pursuing those purposes?
Yeah.
And so those purposes are about the students.
Yeah.
So then how do students learn those things? So it's learning, yes, disciplinary bodies of knowledge, but also how do students learn to become self-regulated, autonomous persons, and members of communities? And then if that's how they learn, how should teachers teach? For deep learning, so I call that in a shorthand, I call that deep learning, which is not new, by the way. No. And then how, if teachers need to teach in particular ways for deep learning, what does that imply for the work of school leaders? So there's a sort of a backward mapping logic from purpose to how students learn those purposes to what do teachers need to teach.
Yeah.
How to teach to for those purposes, and then what does that mean about what leaders need to know and do and be, which is where the virtues come in. Yeah. So that's the virtues. So doing the right work is determined by those backward mapping logic, and then doing it the right way, you bring in the virtues.
Yeah. So what does that mean for me as a principal, and what do I need to know? So then... does that mean I need to know quite a lot as a principal about sort of the science of learning and about evidence-based teaching?
Yes.
It's difficult to lead that if you don't know what you're leading.
Yes, and if you don't know what you're leading, you're not virtuous, according to Aristotle.
No, true.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and of course, the bigger the school that you're leading, the more difficult this becomes, particularly at high school and secondary schools, because there are so many subject areas or key learning areas to cover. So if you're leading a very large school, you need to have a sense of what deep learning is and how it differs from more surface learning.
Yeah.
And that's not that hard, because most modern curricula are written in terms of deep learning, like problem solving, collaboration, transfer of knowledge from taught problems to new problems, being able to apply, being able to be a team player and self-regulate. So most modern curricula, I've looked at the Norwegian one, which is certainly of this nature. I haven't seen the Swedish one, but I'm sure it does emphasize the competencies that we want students to develop, not just their knowledge. Although we should not underestimate the importance of students mastering organized bodies of knowledge, because without knowledge, you can't do anything creative, you can't problem solve, you can't generalize your learning across from one problem to another. So, and you can't read and comprehend if you don't have a good vocabulary. So, so knowledge is really important, but it's then how do you use that knowledge and get plenty of opportunities in your teaching. So you might be very good at maths problems and get the right answer for algebraic numeracy problems.
Yeah.
But you're, as happens in New Zealand, our results for maths problem solving are very weak. And the reason for that is that teachers of students in the lower level classes are taught with quizzes and worksheets.
Yeah.
And they don't get access to word problems. And in order to access word problems, teachers need to teach the vocabulary of mathematics, how to comprehend those word problems. So it's a type of literacy. And many maths teachers are not comfortable teaching that. So they can't teach for deep learning, and the students will do well in maths fluency and numeracy tests, but they will do poorly in problem solving. So that's a really clear example, I hope, of the difference between surface learning and deep learning. So a leader, to come back to your question about leaders, let's say a principal is not a math specialist, but the principal needs to be aware that deep learning is signaled by the results in maths and science, let's say problem solving. So let's look at those results. Yeah. So knowing that there's a problem there, knowing that there's a gap between what the students are currently achieving and where they need to be is important. And then they need to know how to talk to their head of maths about that, just about, you know, they need to be able to judge whether the head of maths, or talk to the head of maths about whether they understand what deep learning is. They need to be a very careful listener to why the head of maths thinks that teaching in that way is too hard for some of the teachers. And then they need to be able to work with the head of maths to build that head of maths skills in how to work with teachers or access the required expertise needed to help that department do a better job of teaching maths problem solving. And so the processes by which you do that, I've outlined that in my book, Reduce Change to Increase Improvement. And also there's a lot on collaborative complex problem solving that throughout my book on virtues. So does that give a sense of how a leader, and I've chosen of a large school, might need to know?
Yeah.
That's just a small part of it, but that's an example.
Yeah. It's interesting and important. I've interviewed quite a number of people about the science of learning and teaching strategies, and sometimes it's a sort of doesn't totally match. So I guess myself or school leaders need to be aware of that we sort of adapt to the science of learning, how the brain learns. But sometimes it's trendy teaching strategies that is not sort of in line with how the brain actually works. It can have some improvement potential, but not worthwhile actually working with.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, there is, you know, there's, when I talk to leaders who have not had a chance to get up to date with this, I tell them that there are three books that I think are very helpful on this. One is, and they're two of them are Australian, so whether that would, Ollie Lovell's book, Tools for Teachers, which is based on the expertise of all the people in his podcast, of many of the people in his podcast. And then his book, Cognitive Load Theory in Action, which is really important in terms of the pedagogy and the science of learning and how to avoid cognitive load. And then Dan Willingham's book, Why Students Don't Like School.
Yeah, I mean, a good one.
That's a very good one. And I think, you know, I talk to school leaders and I say, look, you're not going to, you know, you haven't had a chance to get up to date with this, you know, just don't get sucked into, you know, the fads and fashions, of which there are many. Forget left brain, right brain, and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Just read, you know, these three books, and you'll have a sense of what needs to happen.
Yeah.
And of course, there are lots of and it's the precision of the pedagogy, and there is, and those books are full of really good examples.
Yeah.
Of just the small differences that make, that reduce cognitive load and make and match the way the brain works and match the limitations of our short-term memory.
Yeah.
And those limitations are massive.
Yeah, that's for sure. True. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's also interesting, in your book you're writing about virtues, and you have sort of created a taxonomy of virtues, like three different types. Could you sort of briefly describe these three?
Yes.
At least the first two, because the third one is the one I find the most interesting.
If
all three are important. Yeah.
Yes. Well then, we're having described the right work. Then the next part of the book is about, well, how do you do that work in the right way, and that's in a virtuous way. And I've developed a taxonomy for, because there are hundreds of virtues. So So I've developed three clusters of virtues. And the first cluster is, I call leadership virtues. And I've really, because in a way they're all leadership virtues. But what I mean by leadership virtues is, what is the virtuous motivation for being an educational leader? And that motivation is virtuous when it is linked to pursuit of the distinctive purposes of educational institutions, which is about the students.
Yeah.
And so you want to have greater influence for good on more students than you can as a classroom teacher. You don't want to be a principal because you're doing a better job. You're competing with somebody else because you want to get more money, or you want to get the status. I mean, that's part of it, but your primary motivation to have this virtue is that you want to make a bigger difference for students. So that's pretty straightforward. That's leadership motivation. Then the next one, the next cluster is three problem-solving virtues. And there are three groups in that cluster. One is strategic virtues. The next is analytic virtues. And the third is imaginative virtues. And those are all connected to the critical importance of complex problem solving, that school improvement. They are particularly tailored to the hardest part of the work, which is school improvement.
Yeah.
And school improvement, I've argued throughout this book, is a process of problem solving. It's a process of reducing the gap between what you currently have in your student well-being, in your student achievement, in your student maths results, in the gap between that and the desired state of affairs, or the standard that you as a leader are setting, and closing that gap. Is a process of school improvement or team improvement. It can be at the team level, the group level, the team level, the school level, the network of school level, or the national level. The same process of problem solving applies. And then I go through what this process, and I'm teaching this in five states in Australia at the moment, what this process of collaborative, complex problem solving, and it has five stages, and they're iterative, and depending on the complexity of the problem, it might take you a month to solve the problem, it might take you 2 years or three, and the book's full of examples of how to do this, And those in strategic, the strategic group within the problem solving virtues cluster is about how do you, of the hundreds of gaps that you might tackle, how do you decide which one's the most important?
Yeah.
How do you maintain the focus on that problem and avoid the distractions?
Yeah.
How do you keep it the main focus as well? And how do you communicate with those about it and gain agreement that that's your priority improvement for the term or the year? And so that's strategic. And then not just in the planning process, every meeting and conversation that is relevant, you have that strategic focus in mind. So it affects how you set agendas, how you focus a conversation, how you decide together to park some distractions rather, etc. The yeah. second group is analytic virtues, and these yeah. are about how do you develop in yourself and others the ability to see the causal connections between what, for example, your teachers are doing and not doing and the problem you have of attendance.
Yeah. About the analytic part, you have sort of a sentence that for me is sort of a one-liner that I can't forget, that when you write truth-seeking rather than truth-claiming. And I relate that also a little bit to it's a strategy in social-emotional learning called The Ruler that is developed at Yale. And they talk about emotions, be an emotion scientist, not an emotion judge. It feels like a similar thing, but in a different area. Yeah.
Yes, yes. And I mean, school leaders are so powerful that they need to be able to test the validity of their beliefs, because their beliefs will shape the lives and learning of teachers and students.
Yeah.
And so that notion, that's part of the analytic virtues, is the how do I seek to test the quality of my thinking and the quality of other people's thinking. So included in analytic virtues is that causal logic, the ability to use the ladder of inference to test and check the quality of our thinking, and also to be able to connect our thinking, and this is where the ladder of inference becomes so important, to connect our thinking to why do I think that? What have I noticed? What have I seen? What evidence do I have? Or just what's my logic? And how would I tell if I'm wrong? Yeah. That's the truth seeking rather than truth claiming. And the third group within this cluster of problem solving virtues is imaginative. That's people are sometimes really surprised by this because they don't associate problem solving with creativity, being creative. But many of the complex problems that leaders are tackling in schools, there are multiple conditions that they're trying to satisfy. So they're trying to improve, to go back to the maths example, they're trying to improve the results of students for maths problem solving. Right. In order to solve that problem, they have to they have discovered through their causal inquiry that teachers are not teaching the literacy associated with mathematics. They're not teaching it because they don't think it's their job. They think it's the job of the English teachers because they don't know how to do it. They think that they haven't got time to teach maths and teach maths literacy, so they separate those things. Plus, there's no money to get an external expert. Plus, it has to be done reasonably urgently. Okay, so there we've got constraints around money, time, build teacher capability, change teachers' attitude towards what their job is. In order to solve that problem, you have to bring all of those five things together. And there's huge tensions between those what I call solution requirements. Not the solution, but the solution requirement. There's huge tensions between them. So we have to be imaginative and creative about how do we, without any money, locate resources to help our teachers? How do we move? How do we create space within a crowded professional learning program? How do we create space so that teachers can learn? How do we accept the fact for now that teachers don't want to do this and are skeptical that it'll work in their classroom, and yet at the same time provide opportunities for them to model and see how it might work in their classrooms? That's imaginative virtues, and it's really important. And leaders who set up oppositions and leaders who give up and leaders who can't cope with uncertainty will find it really tough to resolve problems like that.
Good. And then my favorite about interpersonal virtues and trust.
Yes.
It's so interesting. And in many interviews earlier, I've asked everyone, how do you build trust? Many people talk about it's important to build trust, but can't say anything about how do you do that?
Yes, exactly. Yes. Well, because it's collaborative, complex problem solving, I needed a theory and practice of trust building and of collaboration, because we talk a lot about collaboration in education and a lot of it is a waste of time because it's not rigorous, it's not focused, it's not strategic. So how do we build trust quickly while doing the work? And that's one of the key aspects of the theory of trust building that I use, which is that you don't build trust and then do the challenging work. You build trust while doing the challenging work. And that's a student-centered approach, because while you are waiting to do the work while you build trust, the students are still in those teachers' classes, not having good opportunities to learn. So I've used the theory of trust building of Brick and Schneider precisely because, Kennett, they have a very soundly empirically based theory about the causes of trust. And I've outlined those in the book. And then I've used the work of Argyris and Schoen, who are the origins of the idea of theories of action and single loop learning and double loop learning. I was taught by them at Harvard. And so one of their amazing legacies is that they actually teach and taught me how to practice trust building, not just to write about it and talk about it, but how to role play, rehearse, model, and coach the conversations that build trust, which is why there's so many transcripts and examples in the book. So those are those interpersonal virtues also include courage and empathy. And one of the virtues that is most important for leaders who are trying to improve a school or a team is courage. But like many virtues, there's a fine line between virtuous courage and non-virtuous courage, between virtues and vices. And one of the reasons why I've paired courage and empathy is to prevent rudeness, to prevent being a bull in the china shop. Courage is not about just blurting out the horrible thoughts in your head. Virtuous leaders have virtuous thoughts. It's not just virtuous words, it's virtuous thoughts as well. And that becomes really important when you are trying to build trust.
Yeah. You also write about accountability and that, that as a trust builder as well. Could you sort of elaborate a little bit about that?
Yes. Well, in a trusting relationship, you trust, you've been collaborating, let's say, you've agreed on what's going to happen when, by whom, and what's going to be done, and you are reciprocally accountable. You are accountable to each other. One of the things that erodes trust is people don't do what they say they're going to do. That erodes trust. Why are we having a meet? We have a meeting. We have a team meeting. We make these decisions. We agree to plan together next week. And then we have repeatedly two or three people in the team who haven't done the preparation and don't bring their contributions. So that erodes my trust in my team leader and in the team. Why should I bother to go if these, if nobody holds the team members accountable? If we've got a leader who can't say, okay, let's look at it, what everybody's done, who'd like to start, show me the work. Oh, you haven't done it, Mary. Okay, can you tell us why you haven't done it? All right, and then if that pattern, that's accountability. Give me an account of why you haven't done it. And if that is a pattern over, if that is a repeated pattern, then that team leader needs to talk to that team member individually about why this is happening as a pattern, and try to and resolve that issue. Otherwise, the whole team is undermined.
Trust
and trust in the team declines, and trust in the leader declines, because one of the determinants of trust is perception of competence. And a leader who can't hold people to accountable, who can't hold leaders, a leader who can't hold others accountable to agreed decisions will be seen as less than competent, and that reduces trust.
Yeah. You also write a lot about interpersonal respect as a trust builder.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there's two sorts of respect. Respect of self and respect for others. And I think that respect for self is important, because leaders have duties and responsibilities, and they need to be able to take those seriously, even when, especially when others aren't taking them seriously and others are acting in ways which can be seen to undermine trust. So the respect for self is being able to put your own needs as a leader, your duties, on the table. Certain things are non-negotiable, and or at least non-negotiable at the time. So if there's a school policy or about how about staff meetings and when they happen, some teachers may not be happy with that policy and may decide that they're just going to stay away or leave early or not come at all. Then the leader needs to respect self in terms of and others in terms of holding others accountable for complying with that agreement. But the leader also needs to be open, and this is where we come back to open-mindedness and analytic virtues, needs to be open to the possibility that the policy is not correct, that there is something wrong with the policy, but it will be renegotiated collaboratively at a suitable time. It won't be the case that individuals are allowed to unilaterally ignore the policy. So that's respect for self, it's respect for the team, And a type of respect for the other teachers who aren't showing up by being by confronting them, but also being open to the possibility that the policy is actually needs revision at an appropriate time.
Yeah. Connected to this with respect that you describe now, you also write that a virtuous leader strive to be respected rather than liked.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, one of the dangers for leaders is that they've come out of it. Let's say they've come out of a group of teachers that's very close. They a lot of socializing together. They like one another, and then they become a leader. Maybe even of those same people, but maybe in a different context. But if it's in the same context, then the dynamic changes. They need to be able to make the shift from being a peer and a friend to being a respected colleague who may need to have conversations and do things that friends don't like at the time. They need to be able to be transparent and have integrity around why they've done it. But they need to be able to accept the fact that their prior friends may not like them for doing that. They may not agree with the decision. And so that's important. But if a leader is able to be transparent about their reasoning, be able to involve others in a decision and make a decision in a timely way and explain it, then over time, if with that pattern, with that character, then they will come to be respected. And after respect might come liking and loving. So they might be respected, then they'll be liked for what they're doing as a leader, even though at times I don't actually agree. And over time, I mean, they'll come to love their leader, possibly. I mean, that's not, but we don't shoot for that. That's not our goal. Our goal is to be respected. One of the ways in which you develop respect and liking and loving is that you succeed in reaching a difficult goal together.
Yeah.
You know, so this maths problem I talked about, you know, the relationship between the leader and those maths teachers will become hugely trusting and respectful if finally I have a leader who can help me solve that problem.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at sort of different thing that affects students' outcome, collective efficacy, one of the strongest one, and could you say that this, your interpersonal virtue is sort of a key factor to build collective efficacy at the school?
Absolutely. Yeah. And how do you build collective efficacy? By together solving problems you haven't been able to solve before. Yeah. I mean, collective efficacy is an outcome.
Yeah.
You know, you can't build collective efficacy on its own. You can't build collective efficacy by talking about it. You can build collective efficacy by collaborative complex problem solving, which over time builds teachers' sense of agency and efficacy. Yep. We solved that difficult maths problem. It's going to be easier for us now to solve it in science. It's, you know, we've got much more confidence about it. We can do this together.
Yeah. Connected to this, if we build as a next step, you're right, that is also really interesting about how to do improvement, to be successful with improvement initiatives, sort of key factors for success. How should these initiatives be enabled to have potential to be successful?
Yes, well, when I'm teaching, I mean, my model of school improvement is collaborative complex problem solving.
Yeah.
That is the model of school improvement. It's got five stages. You have to be systematic, you have to be rigorous, and you have to be collaborative. So those virtues are all tailored to being able to do that work the right way. And I picked virtues that are particularly relevant to school improvement, because I think that improvement is the hardest part of a leader's job. Because in improvement, by definition, you are disrupting business as usual. Business as usual has not delivered the outcomes for students that you wish for. Doesn't mean they're bad, but they're not. They don't reach the standard that you want. So the way teachers are currently teaching, the way that the pastoral care staff are working with behavior problems and students in difficulty is not working well enough. We still have too many disruptions. We have too many fights in the playground. We have too much student absence despite all this pastoral care. So it's not working well enough. So we need to look at and interrupt the business as usual for pastoral care. And that's hard work. And so the virtues in the taxonomy have been chosen because they are particularly relevant to the work of improvement. And one of them is perseverance, which is a strategic virtue. I've got that in the strategic group. So perseverance is absolutely critical. And another one is courage. They're all actually important, but those two are there because of the difficulty of disrupting business as usual.
You're right. Maybe connected to courage, because you're right that improvements should be specific, that school leaders like me sometimes sort of, it could be one or two or three persons that are doing something that need to be improved, and then you try to do an initiative for the whole group of teachers.
Instead of doing
what you should do, maybe then.
Well, that might be, why do you do that? It's not, you've got three teachers having difficulty or whose results are below the others. So it's really, really, it's really important that you target your improvement to those three teachers and you use others as resources to collaborate and help the other teachers. And too many leaders, they don't want to single out those three teachers. So what they do is highly disrespectful, is that they involve all the teachers without saying that the purpose is to help the three teachers. It's just, it wastes time, it's disrespectful, and it lacks courage. And one of the things I'll do in workshops is I will coach leaders in how to have the conversations with those three teachers or with the whole team to say, you've shared the data. Everyone can see that the data, these three teachers are having more trouble than others for whatever reason. So let's make that discussable. And so we model and practice those sorts of conversations and meetings.
Yeah. I think that would be important training for all school leaders.
Yes.
I guess that connect, because you also write that improvement initiatives should be supportive and non-blaming.
Yes.
And that would be a key if you targeted a few teachers above all the others.
And so how do you have a conversation that is direct, specific, and non-blaming? In other words, respectful instead of blaming. And I, from my experience in the workshops, hundreds of workshops on this that I've run, leaders need a great deal of coaching in how to do that, because they have to unlearn their indirect, vague ways of talking about it. That's what most leaders do. A few leaders will be very direct and blaming, and they will sometimes almost rude. So it's, but mostly it's the soft version rather than the hard control version. Yeah. And we want to teach something that's open-minded, direct, truth-seeking rather than truth-claiming.
Yeah. I think we are about to close up this talk. I will give an advice to all the listeners, and then you give an advice also to all the listeners. My advice would be for all listeners to read the book Virtuous Educational Leadership, Doing the Right Work the Right Way, if you haven't got the book already, because it's really valuable for us school leaders. And now it's your turn.
Okay. Well, thank you. I'll build on your advice, Kenneth, yeah, by saying that not only read it, but if there is a particular virtue, conversation, scenario that is really relevant to a problem you're tackling right now, then why don't you study the transcripts, study the analysis that I've done, and then use your voice memo on your phone or digital recorder and rehearse the conversation and see whether you can coach yourself, because I'm not there, coach yourself in having a virtuous conversation for that situation that you're thinking of, because that's an incredibly powerful way of learning. You get behavioral evidence of your leadership by recording your rehearsed or real conversation. So all the best with that. And thank you so much, Kenneth, for this opportunity.
And thank you so much. And the listeners will be grateful for this episode. It was really valuable for us school leaders. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.